And can you dig it? Loose Wig 4, Side 2.
Welcome. Permit me to introduce myself. I am called Dracula. I am really the Bebop vampire. I like the sun. I like the sun to shine. Drink. We must all drink. Everybody must drink. Today on the market we got instant blood for you to drink. I want you all to drink. Ah, let's see. That's good. That's good. Drink, drink. Quench your thirst. Quench your thirst. Good. Children, you over there, drink your soup before it cracks. Put the children to bed. Children, drink your blood and bite your mama goodnight. Bite your mama goodnight. Put two more marks on your mama's jugular vein. Go away. Go away for the moment. Let me do my work. Go away. Go away. You know I must do my work. I must do my experiments. Go away. I will find a victim. Don't worry. I shall find a victim. Dracula will find a victim. Are you looking strange? You not a vampire? I am a vampire, not you. If you don't stay away, I will take your uglier away, and then you'll become a vampire. Become a vampire, you will understand. Don't worry. Bela will return. Bela shall come back.
Master, those strange sounds. What are those strange sounds, Master?
Don't worry, Chuma. The children of the night make such beautiful music.
Reflecting on my experience, I find myself agreeing with the Cambridge philosopher, Dr. C.D. Broad, that we should do well to consider much more seriously than we have hitherto been inclined to do the type of theory which Bergson put forward in connection with memory and sense perception. The suggestion is that the function of the brain and nervous system and sense organs is in the main eliminative and not productive. Each person is at each moment capable of remembering all that has ever happened to him and of perceiving everything that is happening everywhere in the universe. The function of the brain and the nervous system is to protect us from being overwhelmed and confused by this mass of largely useless and irrelevant knowledge by shutting out most of what we should otherwise perceive or remember at any moment, leaving only that very small and special selection which is likely to be practically useful. According to such a theory, each of us is potentially mind at large, but insofar as we are animals, our business is at all costs to survive. To make biological survival possible, mind at large has to be funneled through the reducing valve of the brain and nervous system. What comes out at the other end is a measly trickle of the kind of consciousness which will help us to stay alive on the surface of this particular planet. To formulate and express the contents of this reduced awareness, man has invented and endlessly elaborated those simple systems and implicit philosophies which we call languages. Every individual is at once the beneficiary and the victim of the linguistic tradition to which he has been born. The beneficiary, inasmuch as language gives access to the accumulated records of other people's experience. The victim, insofar as it confirms him in the belief that reduced awareness is the only awareness, and it bedevils his sense of reality so that he is all too apt to take his concepts for data, his words for actual things. That which, in a language of religion is called the world, is the universe of reduced awareness expressed and, as it were, petrified by language. The various other worlds with which human beings erratically make contact are so many elements in the totality of awareness belonging to mind at large. Most people, most of the time, know only what comes through the reducing valve and it's consecrated as genuinely real by the local language. A guide to some lesser ballets. This one's called Dimitri. It's a ballet opens at carnival. There are refreshments and rides. Many people in gaily colored costumes dance and laugh to the accompaniment of flutes and woodwinds while the trombones play in a minor key to suggest that soon the refreshments will run out and everyone will be dead. Wandering around the fairgrounds is a beautiful girl, Natasha, who is sad because her father has been sent to fight in Khartoum and there's no war there. Following her is Leonid, a young student who is too shy to speak. He's too shy to speak to Natasha, but he places a mixed green salad on her doorstep every night. Natasha's moved by this gift and wishes she could meet the man who is sending it, particularly since she hates the house dressing and would prefer Roquefort. Two strangers accidentally meet when Leonid, trying to compose a love note to Natasha, falls out of a Ferris wheel. She helps him up and the two dance a pas de deux. After which Leonid tries to impress her by rolling his eyes until he has to be carried out to the comfort station. Leonid offers profuse apologies and suggests that the two of them stroll to tent number 5 and watch a puppet show, an invitation that confirms in Natasha's mind that she is dealing with an idiot. The puppet show, however, is enchanting, and a large, amusing puppet named Dimitri falls in love with Natasha. She realizes that though he is only sawdust, he has a soul, and when he suggests checking into a hotel as Mr. and Mrs. John Doe, she is excited. The two dance a pas de deux, despite the fact that she has just danced a pas de deux and is perspiring like an ox. Natasha confesses her love for Dimitri and swears the two of them will always be together, even though a man who works his strings will have to sleep on a cot in the parlor. Leonid, outraged at being overthrown for a puppet, shoots Dimitri, who doesn't die, but appears on the roof of the merchant's bank, drinking haughtily from a bottle of Airwick. The action becomes confused, and there is much rejoicing when Natasha fractures her skull. Like all things on earth, they're compounded of evil and good, more of evil than of good perchance, and written in letters of blood. Did I not tell you one day, when we spoke of good and evil, that out of good came evil and out of evil good, and that they who sowed knew not that what the crop would be, nor he who struck where the blow would fall?
Oh, what are you doing here with the children again, eh? Children, go in the filthy and play with the bats.
This is the typical white person's concept of how we relax colored people at parties. Yeah, it's a hell of a spread. They really know how to put on these people.
Very nice.
Really beautiful. I didn't get your name.
Miller.
My name is Ennis, Mr. Miller.
Nice to meet you.
I never saw you around this neighborhood. You live around here?
Yeah, on the other side.
Oh, okay. I was wondering about that. Hey, Joe Lewis, a hell of a fighter.
Yeah,
hell of a man. Hell of a... That'll be another Joe Lewis. You got a cigarette on you?
Yeah.
Oh, the one you're smoking? I'll put that off you, You know, I don't know these people too well. Are you familiar with them?
No, that's quite a...
I don't know if they're... I think they're heaps. You're not Jewish, are you? No offense. Some of my best friends are Jews. We have them over the house for dinner. They're all right, you know. Some sheenies are no good, but you seem like a white Jew to me. Yeah. At Bojangles. Christ, could he tap dance?
Oh, man.
You tap dance all yourself, huh?
Yeah.
All you people can tap dance, I guess. You people have a natural sense of rhythm. What's that? Born right in you, I guess, huh? Thank you. Yeah, boy. The way I figure it is, no matter what the hell a guy is, If he stays in this place, he's all right. That's the way I look at it. That's what's causing all the trouble in the world. Everybody, like, here's to Joe Louis. Joe Louis was a guy who, the way I figured, he was a guy who just knew when to get in there and get out of there. It's more than I can say for a lot of you niggas. No, I had a few before on the way over here. You know, you're all right. You're a good boy. Did you have anything to eat yet?
No, I haven't.
If there's any watermelon left, fried chicken or dice or raisins, but we'll see if we can fix you up or something. I want to have you over to the house, but I got a bit of a problem now, and I don't want you to think I'm out of line, but I got a sister. And I hear that you guys, you know, it's my sister, and, well, I'll put it to you a different way. You wouldn't want no Jew doing it to your sister, would you? That's the way I feel, you know? I don't want no coon doing it to my sister. That ain't you, and no offense, you know what I mean?
Sure, sure.
And as far as my sister's concerned, shake hands on you. Yeah. We'll do it to her. I hear you got some perfume you put on them and make you do it. Yeah, I'll do it.
No.
Not true? There's no perfume you put on them? They just do it to you? You're all right. Hey, listen, I'd like to have you over the house, I was telling you, but we gotta get stock and...
of the crisis are at the beginning of the modern era, and Galileo and Descartes and the one-sided nature of European sciences, which reduced the world to a mere object of technical and mathematical investigation and put the concrete world of life beyond the horizon. The rise of the sciences have propelled man into the tunnels of specialized discipline. The more he advances in knowledge, the less clearly can he see either the world as a whole or his own self, and he plunged into a forgetting of being. The founder of the modern era is not only Descartes, but also Cervantes. By this I mean that if it's true that philosophy and science have forgotten about man's being, it emerges all the more plainly that with Cervantes a great European art took shape that is nothing other than the investigation of this forgotten being. Indeed, all the great existential themes Heidegger analyzes in Being and Time, considering them to have been neglected by all earlier European philosophy, had been unveiled and displayed and illuminated by 4 centuries of the novel. In its own way, through its own logic, the novel discovered the various dimensions of existence one by one. The novel has accompanied man uninterruptedly and faithfully since the beginning of the modern era. The sole raison d'etre of a novel is to discover what only the novel can discover. A novel that does not discover a hitherto unknown segment of existence is immoral. Knowledge is the novel's only morality. Quixote set off into a world that opened wide before him. He could go out freely and come home as he pleased. The early European novels are journeys through an apparently unlimited world. In Balzac, the distant horizon has disappeared like a landscape behind those modern structures, the social institutions, the police, the law, the world of money and crime, the army, the state. In Balzac's world, time no longer idles happily by as it does for Cervantes. It has set forth on a train called history. The train is easy to board and hard to leave, but it isn't at all fearsome yet. It even has its appeal, its promises of adventure to every passenger and fame and fortune. Later still, for Emma Bovary, the horizon shrinks to the point of seeming a barrier. Adventure lies beyond it. Longing becomes intolerable. Dreams take on importance. The lost infinity of the outside world is replaced by the infinity of the soul, the great illusion of the irreplaceable uniqueness of the individual. One of Europe's finest illusions blossoms forth. But the dream of the soul's infinity loses its magic when history, or what remains of it, the superhuman force of an omnipotent society, takes hold of man. History no longer promises him pain or fortune. It barely promises him a land surveyor's job. In the face of the court or the castle, what can K do? Not much. Can't he at least dream as Emily Bovary used to do? No, the situation's trap is too terrible. And like a vacuum cleaner, it sucks up all his thoughts and feelings. All I can think of is this trial, this surveying job. The infinity of the soul, if it ever existed, has become nearly a useless appendage. The path of the modern novel emerges as a parallel of the modern era. As I look back over it, it seems strangely short and limited. Isn't that Don Quixote himself, after a 300-year journey, returning to the village disguised as a land surveyor? Once he had set out to seek adventures of his own choosing, but now in the village below the castle, he has no choice. The adventure is imposed on him, a petty squabble with the administration over a mistake in his file. Huge editions, widely read in communist Russia. Certainly, these novels add nothing to the conquest of being. They discover no new segment of existence. They only confirm what has already been said. Furthermore, in confirming what everyone says, what everyone must say, they fulfill their purpose, their glory, their usefulness to that society. By discovering nothing, they fail to participate in the sequence of discoveries that, for me, constitutes the history of the novel. They place themselves outside that history, or if you like, they are novels that come after the history of the novel. About a half a century ago, the history of the novel came to a halt in the empire of Russian communism. That is an event of huge importance, given the greatness of the Russian novel. Thus, the death of the novel is not just a fanciful idea, it has already happened. And we know now how the novel dies. Not that it disappears, it falls away from its history. Its death occurs quietly, unnoticed, and no one is outraged. But hasn't the novel come to the end of the road by its own internal logic? Hasn't it already mined its possibilities, its knowledge, and its forms? I've heard the history of the novel compared to a seam of coal long since exhausted. But isn't it more like a cemetery of missed opportunities? Unheard appeals. I don't want to predict the future path of the novel, which I cannot know. All I mean to say is this. If the novel should really disappear, it will do so not because it has exhausted its powers, because it exists in a world grown alien to it. Now, if the novel's raison d'etre is to keep the world of life under a permanent light and to protect us from the forgetting of being, is it not more than ever necessary today that the novel should exist? Yes, so it seems to me, but alas, the novel too is ravaged by the termites of reduction, which reduce not only the meaning of the world, but also the meaning of works of art. Like all of culture, the novel is more and more in the hands of the mass media. As agents of the unification of the planet's history, the media amplify and channel the reduction process. They distribute throughout the world the same simplifications and stereotypes easily acceptable by the greatest number, by everyone, by all mankind. And it doesn't much matter that different political interests appear in the various organs of the media. Behind these surface differences reigns a common spirit. You have only to glance at European or American political weeklies to the left or right. They all have the same view of life, reflected in the same ordering of the table of contents, under the same headings, in the same journalistic phrasing, the same vocabulary, the same style, the same artistic taste, the same ranking of things they deem important or insignificant. This common spirit of the mass media, camouflaged by political diversity, is the spirit of our time. And this spirit seems to me contrary to the spirit of the novel. The novel spirit is the spirit of complexity. Every novel says to the reader, things are not as simple as you think. This is the novel's eternal truth, but it grows steadily harder to hear amid the din of easy, quick answers that come faster than the question and block it off. It's the spirit of our time. It's either Anna or Karenin who is right, and the ancient wisdom of Cervantes telling us about the difficulty of knowing, the elusiveness of truth, seems cumbersome and useless. The novel spirit is the spirit of continuity. Each work is the answer to a preceding one. Each work contains all the previous experience of the novel. But the spirit of our time is focused firmly on a present that is so expansive and profuse that it shoves the past off our horizon and reduces time to the present moment only. Within this system, the novel is no longer a work, a thing made to last, to connect the past with the future, but one current event among many, a gesture with no tomorrow. Does this mean that in a world grown alien to it, the novel will disappear, that it will leave Europe to founder in the forgetting of being, that nothing will be left but the endless babble of graphomaniacs, nothing but novels that come after the history of the novel? I don't know. I really believe I know that the novel cannot live in peace with the spirit of our time if it is to go on discovering the undiscovered, to go on progressing as a novel. It can only do so against the progress of the world.
Dear Judge Axelrod, see, I wrote this out soon ago. I want to do a play. This friend of mine brought this book back from France with the hopes of selling it to the Cleft Hotel, and we'd like you to put some money in it. And I quote from the book now, if I don't transgress. At night, when I look at Boris's goatee lying on the pillow, I get hysterical. Oh, Tanya, now where is that warm cunt of yours? Those fat, heavy garters, those soft, bulging thighs. There is a bone in my prick, 6 inches long. I will ream every wrinkle out of your cunt, Tanya. Big with seed, I'll send you home with Sylvester inside your belly, with your womb turned inside out. Yes, he knows how to build a fire, but I know how to inflame a cunt. I'll shoot hot bolts into you. Okay, by this time, he's had like 3 digitalis.
No, you know what? Dig, this would really be it. No, this would be better yet. Because I'm trying to get the grandchildren into... No, he told the grandchildren because he ain't got his glasses. That's why they get shy. Rifka, read this for me. Okay. Then he's saying, Romania, yeah. It's completely out of it.
Henry Miller, and in the beginning was chaos. This is an article by Michael Frankel. the genesis of the Tropic of Cancer. It was circa 1930-31 in England. The pound was falling, and Lords Ellsworth or other was calling on the city to carry on as if uncertainty were the rule, the natural, the normal thing. In Spain, Alfonso XIII had abdicated, and the Spanish Republic was founded. The same republic that was later to be murdered in cold blood by Hitler and Mussolini while the democracies looked on in tough neutrality. China flood and famine raged over the valleys of the Yangtze and the Huai. Much as usual, perhaps, but Jap thunder rumbled in Manchukuo. Chiapai tossed fitfully in a nightmare of terror and rape while the League of Nations regaled itself with the latest statistics on the dope traffic. Hoover just announced a moratorium on German debt. The pocket battleship Deutschland was launched, and Hitler and his stormtroopers were beginning to march through the streets with a curse on their tongues. The burning of the books was not far off. In America, it was the day after the great crash and the October suicides, and on the eve of the bank holidays. In Russia, deculturization was in full swing, and hunger and famine stalked the plains and the cities. In Italy, the trains were coming in on time, and in France, there was doomer and paralysis and dumb despair. Our little world that the statesmen and politicians had put together the paste and pasteboard of words at Versailles was falling apart again, and everywhere there was uncertainty, confusion, and fear, and utter incomprehension. This was just another economic crisis, people said. There were crises, all kinds, political, economic, social, and whatnot, and this was just another. It would pass like all the others. It would pass with time. The bread lines growing longer and longer day by day. The public soup kitchens swallowing. The factories closing. The currencies breaking. The spirit breaking. The world breaking. There were things that would pass. If not today, then tomorrow. Or the day after tomorrow. Or the day after that. But they would pass. This was just an economic dislocation. The understructure. The underpinnings were sound. So they thought. And all the while, the uncertainty, the apprehension, the fear grew and deepened and spread. It reached out everywhere and left nothing untouched. It felt like a mist, a fog, a condition of the weather. The air was thick with it. It fell a stain, a rust, a gentle dew from heaven, and settled over people's lives and homes, over their thoughts, feelings, words, and acts, over everything they touched or handled, the clothing they wore, the food they ate, the books they read, the pictures they saw. It left their mark. It left its mark on their bodies, their faces. Just another economic crisis. It would pass. The fear and uncertainty would pass. The stain and the rust would pass. The air would clear in time. They didn't know what was behind the crises, what lay behind the stain and rust, the putrefaction that lay behind them and found its way to the surface again and again, like the putrefaction of a silent, secret wound. They did not know that this rust was the same rust that lay on the surface in 1914, and before that, a rust that lay on the surface for many years now, many generations, a rust that no blood from the living or dead could wipe or wash away, as they secretly and naively, in their great desperateness, sometimes thought, feared, and wished. They did not know that this rust was only the merest visible sign of a rust, a malaise below in the silent depths of their being, a rust of soul, a blight of spirit, a death, a spiritual devastation within of the mind, heart, and soul, which no blood of the living or dead could wash away so long as the death underneath remained. They did not know that only by washing away this death would the stain be washed away and the blood cease to flow, the blood drawn again and again to wash away the stain. It was difficult for them to understand the meaning of the recurring crises. The uncertainty and fear, the outer stain which they thought they could wash away with this or that political or economic solution, failed. It was difficult for them to see that the death which lay below, the inner putrescence and heart rot of which these crises, this uncertainty and fear, this outer stain were but surface manifestations. How could they see this inner death? How could they understand the meaning of this outer stain? It was difficult for people to see and understand who had lost the power to see and understand. For what, after all, was this death that they had known? What was it that had fallen, broken deep inside them? The soul, precisely the source of this lost power.
I always ask for the check before I'm finished and make them mad, right? Like, you got two more dishes! I say, man, I can't eat no more of this shit. You order shit, you eat shit! You know people in Mississippi are starving? Who you think you are, Buster Brown?
Thank you.
How could people have lost their soul now without it, now that they had lost it?
What did I do?
Yet it was precisely this power to see and understand what was lost, this knowledge and awareness of death, that made all the difference between being alive and being dead. And the awareness lay whatever possibilities there were for experiencing a sense of life. Unawareness meant apathy, suicide.
The kind who would hurt me, deserve me when I needed you. Yes, you, you're driving me crazy. What did I do to you?
We were at the end of an age, a whole culture, a way of life, and a historical past was coming to a close. Caught up in a process, a cyclical, organic process, and the process spends itself, completes and fulfills itself, resolves. It is not a question of solution, but of resolution. We simply had to face and accept death squarely and resolutely, take it inside, as it were, into our bloodstream, consciously, deliberately face it and accept it in the inmost depths of our being, and live it out. There was no other way of getting rid of it, scotching it. One had to meet it, face it, accept it, and live it out. Live it out, and you set up once the new rhythm, the life rhythm. Live out the old death, and the new life asserts itself at once. One had to be ready for it. One had to have a special temperament and genius for it. One had to stand in a very special relation to oneself and the time for it. There was no salvation for all those up to their ears in death and unaware of it. The man in the street, the politician, the statesman, the so-called man of action, etc. This was a way out for the truly exceptional, creative individual accustomed to working with himself. Finally aware of the dead end we had reached. And determined to strike out on fresh ground at all costs. Individual. In other words, who at this extreme moves not with the times to effect a change in the times, but with himself to effect a change within himself, to come alive to himself. Precisely, the individual, more of an age, has always had the greatest stake.
Chinese fuck quick, too. Wait a minute. Okay. I thought black people could fuck more. Them Chinese be fucking for centuries. A billion people, that's some fucking. Black people got some catching up to do. We like to fuck too long. Yeah, black people like to stay in the pussy 3 and 4 days. Right, thinking of new ways to fuck. Be done. All right, now put your leg here. Get, put your leg around. Now give me your arm. Put, here. Put your pussy on this ladder. Now, turn it. Yeah, now there it is. Oh, shit. Yeah, that's it.
Life provided the key. A personal chagrin of some proportions drove him into a book before he was quite ready for it. This is Thoreau's short little article about Miller. Nothing was planned. He walked into Tropic of Cancer as a man might walk into a darkened operating theater. The voice he heard talking was his own personal voice without overtone or affectation. He began to talk rapidly and confidently to himself on paper. He began to talk about his own life and friends with complete candor and naturalness. The result was not self-conscious confession or revelation. The result, strangely enough, was a swollen manuscript in which the world around him was reproduced in a totally unclassical, unromantic, un-European way. It was the voice of one of the dead-end kids bringing his news of current affairs to the campfire. Was the voice of the Patagonian.
Uh, prison picture with Charles Bickford, Barton McLean, Georgie Stone, Frankie Darrow, Warren Heimer, Nat Pendleton, and the woman across the bay, Anne Dvorak, and her two hooker friends, Iris, Adrian, and Glenda Farrell. It's the break. And cut to the Tower of the Warden, Hume Crone.
All right, Dutch. This is the Warden. You've got 18 men down there, prison guards, who have served me faithfully. Give up, Dutch, and we'll meet any reasonable demands you men want, except the vibrators. Forget it. You're not getting them, Dutch. Can you hear me? This is the Warden. Yada, yada! Yada, 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 Warden! Never mind those Louis Armstrong impressions. Give up. You're a rotten, vicious criminal, a menace to society. Now the handsome but mixed-up prison doctor, H.B. Warner.
My son buried many years ago when I knew your father.
Where do you come off that Billy Daniels jazz, you nitwit? Shut up, I'm the warden. You don't want to kill anybody. Dutch, you punk, you're pushing me too far. You better give up. Yada, yada! Shut up, you goddamn nut, you! Yada, yada. I'm sorry I gave him that library card now. I don't know what the hell to do. Maybe if we just... Maybe if we kill a few for an example. That may do it. Tower C! You want to put the cards down for a minute, huh? That's right. Kill about 700 down there. Go ahead. I said it's all right. Now kill them. Come on, I'll get snotty, you guys. You're going to kill them now? The ones in the gray shirts. The bullets? Look at the back of my brown slacks. Forget it. Cockamamie prison here. No one wants to help you. I'll kill about six of you with my police special. Wait a moment. Before there's any killing, I'll get down there. Not you, Father Flotsky. So I'm going down there. Will you come off the Pat O'Brien bits now? Father, you don't understand. These guys are monsters. They're vicious criminals. They got knives and guns. Sure, and you seem to forget, don't you, that I've got something stronger than a gun. You mean... That's right, jujitsu. Well, you're making a mistake, Father Flotsky. Son, the mistake is mine to make, and I'm going down there. Cut to the worst part of the last mile. Real Uncle Tom scene, death row. The first cell.
What a boy. Well, well, soon I gwine up to heaven on the big river boat. Then when I gets up there, I gwine get me a lot of fried chicken and watermelon. Fried chicken and watermelon. Fried chicken and watermelon, that's what I gwine get when I get up to that big river boat in heaven, goddamn. Yes, sir, boss. You see, you don't mind dying, boss, if you got a natural sense of rhythm. Yuck, 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 yuck.
The next cell. Somebody's gonna get fried tonight. Tonight, tonight, someone get fried tonight. More people using natural gas than ever before. Tonight.
Shut him up! Shut that nut up!
Fry somebody tonight. They're gonna fry somebody.
Shut him up! Shut that nut up!
You can call me a nut when it's published. It goes, fry somebody tonight. Back to the bridge. It's a wild tune. Now the guy is going to the chair. The last mile. So long, Marty. Here's my playing cards, kid. Here's my mezuzah wong. And there's that door. I don't want to go in there. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do.
Don't sit down, Marshal.
Back to the yard with Father Flotsky.
Hello, Dutch. Dutch, you don't remember Father Flotsky now, do you, son? You know, Dutch,
You know, there's an old story that once a boy goes the bad road, the good road is hard to follow. When the good road is hard to follow, the bad road opens when the good road closes. You're not a bad boy, Dutch. Killing 6 children doesn't make anybody bad now. You don't remember, do you, Dutch, that this is Arthur Shields for Swiss Colony Wine? Now, Dutch, I told them up there in the tier that I take the gun away from you, and I'm going to do it, Dutch. Now, come on. He's going to give it me. Come on, Dutch, give me that gun now. Come on, Dutch. Come on, don't be schmucking him. Give me the gun. Give me the gun there. Yada, yada. Yada, yada, father. You're right, he's a goddamn nut. Try to give me all that Rosicrucian jazz and all those other non-schedule theologies there. They're no good, a lot of them. Pour it in.
You men, the prison guards, I know this smacks of an insalubrious deed. I've got a job to do. The pension I'm not going to screw up. I know it's cold, guys, but what the hell? You know what this gig is? It's dog eat dog. You know what the gig was when you took it? Only hope that your old lady swung with Mutual of Omaha. Dutch, you've got 3 seconds. 3 big ones. You going to listen to anybody?
I'm listening to nobody. I'm listening to nobody in this whole stinking prison ward. Nobody.
Dutch, listen to me, Bubby.
Who is that?
It's Kiki, the hospital attendant. The one who gave you the bed baths. Give up, Bubby. Don't screw up your good time.
Kiki, you nasty, you. Kiki, baby, I'll give it all up for you.
Did you hear that? He's giving it up for me. I feel just like Wally Simpson. I don't believe it. He's giving it all up for me. Did you hear that, you bitches in sub-block 11? My nerves. He's giving it up for me. Did you hear him, Warden?
I heard him, you fruit.
Watch it, Warden. Don't overstep your bounds now. Are we going to get all our demands? What do you want? A gay bar in the West Wing? All right, you'll get. What else? I want to be the Avon representative of the prison.
That winter, Alice Tolkis and Picasso and myself took a villa in the south of France. This is a 1920s memory. Woody Allen was then working on what I thought was a major American novel, but the print was too small and I couldn't get through it. In the afternoons, Gertrude Stein and I used to go antique hunting in the local shops. I remember once asking her if she thought I should become a writer. In a typically cryptic way, we were all so enchanted with, she said, no. I took that to mean yes and sailed for Italy the next day. Italy reminded me a great deal of Chicago, particularly Venice, because both cities have canals and the streets abound with statues and cathedrals by the greatest sculptors of the Renaissance. That month I went to Picasso's studio in Arles, which was then called Rouen or Zurich until the French renamed it in 1589 under Louis the Vague. Louis was a 16th century bastard king who was just mean to everybody. Picasso was then beginning on what was later to be known as his Blue Period, but Gertrude Stein and I had coffee with him, and so he began it 10 minutes later. It lasted 4 years, so the 10 minutes didn't really mean much. Picasso was a short man who had a funny way of walking by putting one foot in front of the other until he would take what he called steps. We laughed at his delightful notions, but toward the late 1930s, with fascism on the rise, there was very little to laugh about. Both Gertrude Stein and I examined Picasso's newest works very carefully, and Gertrude Stein was of the opinion that all art is merely an expression of something. Picasso disagreed and said, "Leave me alone, I was eating." My own feelings were that Picasso was right, he had been eating. Picasso's studio was so unlike Matisse's in that while Picasso's was sloppy, Matisse kept everything in perfect order. Oddly enough, just the reverse was true. In September of that year, Matisse was commissioned to paint an allegory, but with his wife's illness, it remained unpainted, and finally it was wallpapered instead. I recall these events so perfectly because it was just before the winter that we all lived in that cheap flat in the north of Switzerland where it will occasionally rain and just suddenly stop. Juan Gris, the Spanish cubist, had convinced Alice Toklas to pose for a still life and with his typical abstract conception of objects began to break her face and body down to its basic geometrical forms until the police came and pulled him off. Gris was provincially Spanish and Gertrude Stein used to say that only a true Spaniard could behave as he did. That is, he would speak Spanish and sometimes return to see his family in Spain. It was really quite marvelous to see.